You're listening to Black Hastings Speaks, a production of UC Hastings Law and its Center for Racial and Economic Justice. I'm your host, Arika Smith. This series was created in the aftermath of the killings of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd, and amidst the 2020 uprising sparked by these tragedies. The goals of the project are to foster healing, build connections, encourage systemic change, and deepen empathy on issues of anti-blackness. In this episode, you'll hear Elizabeth McGriff interviewed by Lauren Lofton, both vital UC Hastings staff members. Elizabeth, who graduated from the college in 1996, directs the Legal Education Opportunity Program, LEOP for short, and serves as the Equity and Inclusion Advisor to the college. Lauren, who uses they, them, their pronouns, joined Student Services earlier this year as the Associate Director for Student Life and Inclusion. Prior to this, they worked at the Legal Aid Association of California in Oakland.
I'm very inspired by our young people and their willingness and their actual action in taking up the mantle and carrying what, you know, we call the bloodstained banner way back in the day during the civil rights movement to modern day, and really demanding without exception or without reservation that there be real actual change, and that it happen in some respects at once, and really messaging that we are no longer going to accept, oh, give us time. Well, how much time is needed? It's been centuries. And I am just heartened by their action, by their insight, by some of the very cerebral young people I see all over talking about our challenges and acting on the challenges and showing real leadership, because that is what will be needed. That's what is needed. My big thing has always been that I'm African-American first. That's really the first thing I think people see, is I'm African-American. And of course, being a woman is, you know, clearly a part of my identity. But as African-American people, I think many of us find that no matter how we perceive ourselves, when we're walking out in public and in communities, one of the first observations about us is our color. And then perhaps sometimes our gender is secondary. But it certainly has presented unique opportunities for me. It's an experience that is one that is easy to share with other women of color in terms of getting a comprehensive mutual understanding of what our experiences are like. I think that for people who are not Black women, they don't necessarily see the challenges that we have or understand what our experiences are. While I do think, quite frankly, that in this society, that many find Black women less threatening than Black men, we still have to overcome, as one young man put it recently, he said, why is it that we, when it comes to police interactions, why is it that we are guilty until proven innocent instead of innocent until proven guilty? So there's this, I think there's frequently a challenge, depending on what circles you're running in, to sort of disarm people, or feel the need to disarm people with respect to how they perceive African-American women, any stereotypes they may have. And I'm always struck by when I'm at a social event and someone finds out that I'm an attorney and they're visibly taken aback and don't quite know what to say. So they spend all of this time trying to figure out, how could I possibly not only have a college education from an elite women's college, but also have a Juris Doctor from one of the preeminent law schools in the country and be a member of the California Bar? It can often be a lot to process, quite frankly. And it just always strikes me as a very odd experience, because why wouldn't it be presumed that that is something that we could attain? Instead, I have to be perceived as the exception, or I have to have this whole backstory as to how I could possibly have accomplished these things. And it hasn't changed in the, you know, nearly 25 years since I graduated law school.
Those last experiences that you were talking about are experiences that I've struggled with my whole life. And I am a biracial person. I have a Black father who is a prominent attorney, and I have a white mother who has multiple disabilities and is low income. And there have been so many presumptions in my life about which parent has access to resources and income and which parent is an attorney. If I don't say which parent is the Black parent and which parent is the white parent, people will assume I have a white attorney father instead of a Black attorney, Harvard-educated father. And when I say that I've experienced growing up in a low-income single-mother household, people will then assume that my mother is a low-income Black woman. And just what gets put on us in terms of frameworks and what gets presumed about our families and our background.
Law school is different now in a lot of ways. One of the biggest changes I've seen is the dramatic decrease in the number of African-American students at our law school. When I was there, we had close to 100 law students, 1Ls, 2Ls, and 3Ls combined. And we just have fewer African-American students now, and it is rather pronounced. And this is a challenge that exists at many law schools. It's not just at UC Hastings. It's something you see pretty broadly. So that, for me, is a very pronounced difference because we were such a fairly critical mass of students when I was there. And now it's just that is not the case. The students that we do have are quite strong together as a unit. But that is one of the big differences. I stay in regular contact with students all the time as it is, right? You know, it's by email, phone, tech, whatever. And so with the tragic events of late, the other part of this is that we're technically, even though summer is not until I think Saturday, this is the summer season for the law school. At this time during the year, usually what you see is, yeah, you'll have some student engagement, but it's nowhere near what you would normally have during the school year. This year so far, the level of student engagement that I've had is probably at least quadruple what it typically is. Because of students reaching out. Well, the first, we had the pandemic and all of those related issues that students were having, many of which were emergency situations. But as the events unfolded with George Floyd, there was a big uptick in students reaching out. And I'm connecting with students well after, 9 or 10 o'clock at night, early in the morning, on the weekend. I generally do work every day. It's not an exaggeration, 7 days a week. That is how I do it, to allude to your earlier question. The real pain, so there's multiple layers. There's the pain that we're dealing with, that students are dealing with, which translated very quickly into what is our state in general as Black Americans, but more specifically at UC Hastings. Let's take stock of that. As students, and let's think about some of the kinds of things that need to be done. But what cannot be discounted is, people hear the word pain, and I think we often think of it in general terms. But for me, who, because of my mother, have been obsessed with the news since I was a very young child. And as my pastor says, a good lawyer ought to have a case book in one hand and a newspaper in the other. And so as I sit and watch the news every morning, the experience that I have been having every day is my own set of tears every single morning. I have two grandsons, right? That I have to think about, not to mention the fathers, my father and the other men in my family, two young grandsons. And I remember when the case, when I first saw the news about the case, I just, it's like somebody putting a knife through you. It is this pain that that causes nightmares, and that, every time I just see him or I see his daughter, I see our people, it just hurts. And because I am a high sensitive person, it just is, it's difficult. So for me, the big challenge has been processing my own pain and at the same time being able to hopefully effectively serve and support students during this time. Because the pain is real. There's a lot that I cannot watch, whether it's with regard to George or Rayshard Brooks, whomever. It's very difficult for me to watch. I grew up at a very young age, probably 7 or 8. I think Roots came out in 1977. Watching Roots, watched the series 2 or 3 times. I saw Kunta Kinte's foot being chopped off. These are the kinds of things that leave an indelible impact on you emotionally and psychologically. And I sit here and I reflect back and I look at now we're in 1977, 2020. What is different? What is really different? And of course, the 1977 series is in reference to something that was happening, hundreds of years prior to that. But even so, what is, so I can't escape the question of what is different in terms of what our experience is in this country. And just acknowledging the fact that, yeah, things may not always be so horrific. Maybe somebody's not getting their foot cut off. But how is that showing up in other ways? How is the same impact showing up in other ways in the corridors of businesses and academia, et cetera? It still shows up. It may not be an actual physical somebody cutting off your foot, but you still have the aggressions or the oppression that takes place. And so it's just the inescapable question for me. What has changed?
So I would like to offer to you from Audre Lorde, caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it is self-preservation. And that is an act of political warfare.
Oh, that's a beautiful quote. Powerful. Short, but powerful. Mm-hmm. I think it's really the thing that should be adopted for many people, but particularly women. Women are the ones who, almost without exception, seem to be the ones to say, self-care can wait. But I do know that there seems to be a self-care movement afoot, and I think that's a great thing. And that quote really should be, laminated, blown up and laminated and put all over the place as a
reminder. I put it everywhere that I can. It's part of what brought me to Hastings is that my role includes wellness. And I was doing continuing legal education for attorneys. I was doing continuing legal education specific to substance use and abuse and self-care so that we are not continuing to suffer in the same ways that in this legal profession we often have in terms of rates of addiction, alcoholism, secondary trauma from processing whatever's happening with our clients in a way that then we perhaps take out negatively on ourselves. And doing a lot of elimination of bias programming as well and surfacing what kind of trauma comes out of just the daily experience of being someone who is marginalized and perhaps marginalized in multiple ways and might be one of the few people in spaces that we're navigating through. And I really wanted an early intervention opportunity where these attorneys would just be crying in my sessions, right? And they would be crying because it's perhaps the first time anyone has named this experience where they're just working themselves into the ground and they've got that same sink or swim. When I went to law school as well. And so I'm excited to just create a different way of being for this next generation of lawyers by supporting them to figure out what is best for themselves. Like, how do they take care of themselves to sustain this work? Because civil rights work, civil justice work, all of this takes so much to keep it going.
Oh, absolutely. As I said earlier, you learn what you live. And my mother was 4-time, not only was she department chair at the college where she worked, she was 4-time NAACP president and did other social in San Francisco and did other social justice and civil rights work even prior to that. And so that is what I grew up learning, whether it was going to marches or press conferences about highly charged, relevant issues to the African-American community or legislative work. It is what I lived and breathed the entire time that I grew up. It's pretty inescapable for me. And I carry that into my work with students in terms of what are the essential things that marginalized students need or under-resourced students need, and what is going to help them thrive. That's been my experience. And I think that is how I functioned. You just make it a part of some of these things are part of your lifestyle and figure out how to decompress from that. You got to take breaks from it. but you have to be able to give off the, you know, get off the sidelines and back into the game. You have to, especially when there may not be enough people doing that work. There really may not be enough people. And if you are one of the few essential people who are willing to do it and who are effective at it, then that suggests to me that's a calling on your life that you are sort of duty bound to respect. So that's also the way I look at these things. You know, there's a mission and a calling on each of our lives that come in a sealed envelope that we never see. And our job is to figure out what it is and to do the job. And I mean, I was said to someone yesterday that, you know, there's all this talk about meeting the moment. Yeah, it's a fine phrase, but the reality is I have no interest in just meeting the moment whatsoever. I have an interest in meaningful systemic change that has a transformative effect on the lives of African-American people. And that I think, frankly, it's one of our biggest fears is that this is a meet the moment situation. We can't afford to have a meet the moment situation when it comes to equity, parity, and fairness for African-Americans. And, you know, for anyone, quite frankly. But the reality is we've been sidelined for so long. And, you know, one of my key things is why is there any novelty about any of this narrative or this discussion? Quite frankly, I find the novelty aspect of it to be offensive. We're talking centuries of this. This has been discussed for centuries. These issues have been issues for centuries. Why is there novelty? Oh, wow. Oh, no one had any idea that these things were going on. It's utterly preposterous. And I am grateful. I am very grateful that the attention is being shown to these matters. But the reality is the novelty with which this is being treated is jarring. And I, quite frankly, from a cognitive standpoint, I have great difficulty processing it. And I don't know if others feel that way, but I feel very strongly about that.
I mean, why is the Black experience still so shocking to mainstream America? Why does it feel like African Americans are invisible, like we're a novelty in our own country? Mm-hmm. Like we've been saying this and saying this and saying this, and meeting the moment is really, that is a bare minimum. And the goal should always be transformation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I don't understand.
I don't understand. And, you know, I tell people all the time, I am not a character in a Ralph Ellison novel. I am not the invisible woman. Never have been, never will be, nor will African American people. And so once other people can figure that out, then we might be halfway onto something. But, you know, we must refuse to be treated as invisible people. And there should be some acknowledgement of the powerful, positive, indelible impact African Americans have made on this country for centuries. The reality is much of what we see, whether it's construction of buildings or the third rail, you know, that BART rides on, and all kinds of other inventions that African Americans have made, and all kinds of other academic and cultural contributions we've made to the society, those should be acknowledged.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Pre-Lyft and Uber, my dad used to send me across the street to hail taxis because he said, they're not going to stop for me. But right. Once you get one and you get the door open, I'll run across the street. And
the
join
street.
You. And we used to do that, you know, and then with Lyft and Uber, it was like he would have people cancel rides on him, presuming mm-hmm. he wouldn't tip them or whatever.
Whatever. And that's why we have to, you gotta continue the fight, continue the motivation, continue to make sure that there is a focus on these matters. And that we're not by any notion in a post-racial society. I frankly find that offensive.
Yes.
Nowhere near it. So I think it's just, you know, important to understand the dynamics that exist right now, but also to really actively embrace Blackness and its beauty and to seek and promote Black joy as well. Because our narrative cannot be a 24/7, 365, 366 in a leap year narrative of trauma and negativity and depression. We deserve more than that. We are a beautiful, resilient people. And we need to focus not only on the issues that need to be addressed, but on how to promote ourselves and to promote healthy living and love for one another and solidarity.
The op is Systemic Change at Hastings in response to the civil unrest in 1968 following Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. What systemic change would you like to see at Hastings come out of this 2020 civil rights movement and national conversations on anti-Blackness?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think certainly we need to really be focused on the recruitment of students and faculty of color, not just recruitment, but the retention and development of those people, as well as making sure that they feel included and are not just bodies on the campus. And in addition to that, I would say that, you know, we need to really be focused on creating an inclusive pedagogy at the law school. And I know that some efforts are underway to do just that. And so I hope that we're effective in doing that. And also the climate and the culture at the law school, finding ways to make it inclusive for African American students, and fostering an environment that promotes success of those students. And recognizing that people from all walks of life are critically important to our institution. And in the absence of African American students in numbers that are significant, I think that we are missing out as an institution. And I think the impact on the profession with regard to diversity and different viewpoints and equity and more, there will be great deficits in the absence of having students from African American backgrounds, and understanding that our students that we do have need to be supported. And I feel that this is true, again, not only at UC Hastings, at many law schools. It is vitally important to understand the perspective and some of the culture that African American students bring to the law school, and also our role in history in the law and what that means as a practical matter, and making sure that we don't ignore those things and that we address them head on. And so I think it's vitally important, and not just from one level. You know, I'd like to see this permeate the institution on a department to department basis. And, you know, clearly not just with respect to African-American students, to students from diverse backgrounds and marginalized backgrounds, so that we are an inclusive institution, and that these issues and concerns are uppermost in the minds of people as they create programs, as they develop policies and procedures and protocols, so that we have an environment that is not only reflects diversity, because I don't believe in just numbers. You know, we can rattle off that we've got, I don't know, 49% diverse students. What does that mean? Let's unpack that. What does that mean? How many of those students are from historically underrepresented backgrounds? And making sure that we bear in mind the relevance and the importance of the people that work there, as well as the students who are there to receive their legal education. Making sure that the students understand when they get that there's somebody. See, the thing is, the students don't care what you know until they know that you care. There have to be caring individuals there who see the students, who recognize the students, who hold themselves out as people who will support them. And of course, there's academic support that we need, but all students need academic support. There are other kinds of support that they need. They need the social, emotional support. They need resources. So whether that's human bodies in terms of resources or financial resources, other kinds of resources. So there needs to be an identification of what the needs are to begin with, and an understanding of what they are and why those needs are important. And then from there, you build out and find ways to support students. You know, they have affinity groups, they need support, they need advocacy to some extent on their issues. So it can look like so many different things. And advocacy could show up in the context of their education, their housing, their healthcare at the college, their finances. It's quite a long list. So I think
alumni
just
connections.
Even alumni connections, external support, partnerships. There's a lot of layers, but the needs are there. So I think it's A, understanding that there are needs, B, identifying those needs, and then C, figuring out how to execute in such a way that it militates in favor of the students.
Thank you for listening to Black Hastings Speaks. to hear all of the episodes in this series and learn more about the participants, go to www.uchastings.edu/speak.